Muddy Knees Media.
Totally Football Show. And it's a big look forward to the weekend with Liverpool, Man United and so much more. West Ham, Everton. Will Carlo be cocking his eyebrow? Will David Moyes? And how would we know? Arsenal, Sheffield United. Historically a poor record for Blades against the Gunners, going right back to the Light Brigade. But half a league on, will this be different? And every weekend is special when you're Mike Dean, but why this one is especially so. All that and more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Ta-da! Hello, listener. We've got a Duncan Alexander for you.
Hi.
Today. Duncan, very much pumped for Mike Dean.
Yes, as I have been throughout my life in many ways.
Nice. Daniel Sturridge is also here.
Good morning.
Bringing with him a fresh take on this Jose Mourinho fellow, I believe. Is that right, Daniel?
Why not, yeah.
Go on, then. And who's this seething after last night's events at Old Trafford? It's Lindsay Hooper.
I'm just going to do loads of pointing, same as it's Mike Dean. Pointing.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's nice. Thematically. Yeah. On topic. So, Old Trafford last night, Lindsay, you know, because you
I did try
Walt...
to deflect that then. Yeah, it wasn't the best performance by either side, but yeah, Manchester United went through. Deserved in the end.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
1-0, one matter. Neto with the opening, what would have been the opening goal, disallowed after that.
You've got to feel for him. He scored at Anfield and at Old Trafford and had both of them overturned for VAR.
Wow. Wow. All for the handball and the build-up.
Well, yeah.
Obviously, a lot of people pointing out that goal and the handball, but it was a pretty important handball. It did deflect the ball into his path. So I don't, you know, in the olden days, when that probably wouldn't have been seen and had been allowed, equal number of people would have been complaining that that goal had stood. So I don't think it's that bad, is it?
Just going to shut your VAR chat down.
Yeah.
If you're going to go down the route of discussion, which was if it was the defender, it would be okay.
Yeah.
But that means that the law needs addressing. It isn't VAR's fault.
Yeah. What else happened in those replays midweek, Daniel?
Carlisle 3, Cardiff 4. That's the best game of the week. I saw Gary Lineker was tweeting about end replays because there are a fly in the ointment of Premier League teams kind of misunderstanding the whole point of the FA Cup entirely. But also then people saying, yeah, it's just boring replays between rubbish EFL teams. It's like, well, there was a 4-3 tonight, which was a hell of a lot better than Wolves Man United.
Carlisle, who had been the lowest ranked team left in the tournament, exiting though... Cardiff will go on to play... Is it Coventry they play next?
No, Coventry-Birmingham in the St Andrews derby.
Oh, wow.
Because both teams... Obviously, Coventry playing there this season because of their decrepit owners.
Sure, so Birmingham are going to have to be in the away end?
Well, actually, I think they've agreed to split the crowd 50-50.
Okay. I'm sure there'll be some dressing room banter going on. Oh, is this our dressing room? No, it's not. Just to counter you on replays, I'm not entirely convinced replays are necessarily a good thing. I mean... I see all the arguments, but most of the arguments boil down to that replays give lower league teams an opportunity to, you know, make more revenue from the FA Cup. Mm. Now, when they scrapped multiple replays, there was the similar sort of, this is the end of the FA Cup, and that didn't happen. Mm. I think if you redistribute the money a bit more...
Well, it wasn't a sudden end anyway.
No, but if you read it...
May have added to the gradual decline.
I guess that's the question.
It isn't just money. There is also the notion that a lower team against a high-ranked team is more likely to be able to perform in a one-off scenario, and therefore extra time and penalties gives them a better chance than...
That was Gary Lineker's argument.
Well, he says get rid of them completely, and I say...
Yeah,
well,
and he was saying that basically having a one-off game would be give a bigger chance of an upset.
Yeah, but I think the idea with the money has to overshadow all of that, because, as you say, Doug, if you redistribute it, fine, but that's not going to happen.
Well, yeah,
it?
But what I find a little bit annoying is this kind of idea that the FA Cup is set in stone. You know, there was a two-legged FA Cup after the war. Preston rotated their goalkeepers in 1988-89 between the league and the FA Cup. So it's not like there's been this...
What's strange about that?
Well, people will say, oh, look at these modern Premier League teams.
No, but about them rotating their goalkeepers.
Well, that was pretty unusual in the 19th century.
Right, okay.
But it's one of those examples of how, you know, it hasn't always been as people think it has been in the past.
Right. That's a fair point, Duncan. Fair point. Cardiff, by the way, just to kind of finish that one off, will be taking on Reading, who beat Blackpool 2-0 away. Coventry got through after their 3-0 win over Bristol Rovers. Newcastle breezed past Rochdale 4-1. Among the goal scorers,
Joe Ellington. Yeah, I mean, it feels slightly damning with faint praise to pour compliments on him after scoring against a pretty poor League One team,
right,
but who helped Newcastle with all of their goals. But yeah, he needed a goal, put it that way.
One of Newcastle goals came from a fairly grim error from Rochdale keeper.
And you passed straight to Almiron.
Yeah, essentially. And we saw a similar thing in the Spurs game as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I might be biased as someone who follows Wickham, who definitely don't play a passing a game. But, you know, there are a lot of lower league teams who have clearly been influenced by Pep Guardiola. And that's good and admirable. But, you know, sometimes their eyes are bigger than their
belly.
Their feet.
Yeah.
Kind of in this case.
Yeah,
but yeah, I know what you mean. That was the opening goal for Spurs, gifted by Borough keeper Thomas Mejias.
Yeah, and that's an issue because they have just sold Darren Randolph back to West Ham to cover for Lukas Fabianski's injury. So they are now in the market, I suspect, for a new keeper. It's not a brilliant shop window for Mejias.
No. Okay. Also, Shrewsbury won against Bristol City and will face Liverpool. 89th minute, defender Aaron Pierre drilling it in from 25 yards out. Scenes.
You could tell that the sheer weight of the celebration, that was a we're going to play Liverpool celebration. It was really nice.
Right. No Tranmere Watford, I'm afraid. That was postponed due to the evocatively named Storm Brendan.
No, not just Storm Brendan, the shoddy pitch.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a sandpit,
yeah, it's
isn't
so
it?
Bad. And Emma Hayes in the women's game had criticised it, hadn't she, some weeks ago, and then got quite a backlash
quite
about, for
yeah,
it.
People were like, well, if it's good enough for Tranmere, why is it not good enough for the women's game? I was like, well, maybe it's not good enough for Tranmere.
Right. Maybe it's not good enough for anyone.
Right. Okay, well, assuming they can sort that out, the game will be replayed in a week's time. If Watford make it through, they're going to end up playing 4 games in 9 days. Madness.
And that FA Cup game will be at home to Manchester United. So it's, yeah, their run is tough.
It's good madness, though.
Yeah, it is good.
You
want to
be playing when you're playing well.
Mm.
It would have been pure madness around 7 weeks ago.
Right. And they are playing so very well now, though.
Yeah.
As we'll discuss, you know, presently, because after this, let's get on to the weekend.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
FA Cup third round replays tick. Premier League, hello, big game is Liverpool Man United on Sunday, but there are other delights too, Lindsay.
There are. There's a lot of really good games this weekend. You have to look down the bottom as well. Bournemouth playing Norwich.
Yep.
That's going to be a very important result.
One of two relegation 6-pointers. You've also got Brighton up against Aston Villa, a game which could see the two teams swap places should scorelines, you know, go in that direction. Also, Man City taking on Palace. West Ham, with David Moyes, facing his old team, Everton. And the game that, controversially, I'd like to start with, Arsenal, Sheffield United. Flaky Gunners, who may or may not have turned the corner under Arteta, facing the Sheffield steel of Chris Wilder's Blades. And no Aubameyang.
Which means Lacazette's got to actually play football a bit. He's actually had 16 shots on target this season, 5 goals. Compare that with Aguero, who's had 18 shots on target and scored 13 goals.
Arsenal have actually only won one of their last 7 matches at home, though it was their last one, which was against Man United. So, better or not under Arteta, Daniel?
Yeah, definitely. Not necessarily in terms of results, although there has been a slight improvement, but certainly the main criticism of Unai Emery is you couldn't really work out what they were even trying to do, never mind achieving. There is a new identity there is a new discipline there, there is a goodwill there, which is important because that certainly wasn't there in Emery's last month. So yeah, different feel, but a fair reminder that it's going to take a heck of a long time. I think
Sheffield United start the day 4 points ahead of Arsenal. They haven't won away at the Gunners for 48 and a half years, since in fact August 1971, when the aptly named I'm Still Waiting by Diana Ross was number one. Arguably, they've not had many better chances than this one. So to hear how they stand going into this, let's hear from the Sheffield Stars, James Shield. When you say, little girl, please don't wait for me. Wait patiently for love. Sheffield United's record, we were just saying, away to Arsenal, not the best. But we feel that rarely have you had a better chance to change that. What do you think?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, they've obviously not won down in North London since the early 70s. Mm. So that's something that they're going to be looking to put right. It was actually before I was born. I'll just get that one in there. But no, you're absolutely right. I think this is a really good opportunity, not only for them to put that record straight, but also to sort of continue climbing the Premier League table. And it's right. It really has been one of the stories of the season so far. I know I probably would say that, but even if I didn't cover Sheffield United, I think as an old footballing romantic of a certain vintage, I think it's lovely to watch a club, you know, obviously come not only out of the Championship last season, but come out of League One, doing it the old-fashioned way, if you like. And by that, I mean giving players an opportunity and not just sort of constantly reaching for the checkbook and signing big money numbers. I think it's a really nice tale.
Yeah, there's been a lot of people hastily educating themselves this season on the likes of John Lundstrom and particularly now John Fleck.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And do you know what? I've actually been sort of talking with colleagues about that this week. But, you know, players like John Lundstrom and John Fleck, you look at how they're doing in the top flight now and sort of how easily they've made that transition. Easy is perhaps the wrong word because obviously there's an awful lot of work gone in to what they do and what the club do as a whole behind the scenes. But, you know, it's been a relatively seamless transition. And you do wonder why, you know, not so many years ago, only sort of 2 years ago in some cases, a lot of these players were sort of playing League One football and, you know, didn't have sort of teams clamouring to sign them or take them on and give them an opportunity. Sheffield United have obviously done that and they're reaping the rewards for it now. But I think it just does go to show sometimes, you know, we live in an era where there's sort of all this software and there's all these statistics to do with sort of scouting systems and looking at what players do and tracking their careers. I think sometimes, you know, what's happened here does go to show that sometimes it just comes down to a manager's hunch or a coach's hunch and just believing what their own eyes are telling them.
Defenders who score, forwards who don't. Will David McGoldrick ever get a goal and does it matter?
Well, I think for his own sanity, it probably matters because you've seen him looking pretty sort of frustrated when some, what you've got to say, are absolutely golden opportunities have gone begging for him. There was one at Brighton and Hove Albion last month, actually, where he rounded the goalkeeper. There's an open goal there. And I think everybody in the press box and in the away end was holding their breath, thinking this is finally the moment that David McGoldrick scores. And of course, he managed to find the post instead. I mean, obviously, we've spoken with Chris Wilder a great deal about this, and he's made the point that, you know, even if David McGoldrick doesn't score between now and the end of the season, he said he will always be in my team. Now, I think obviously Chris would love David McGoldrick to score, and let's be honest, he does need to get a goal. But what I will say is, I understand where the manager's coming from on that, because Sheffield United do play better when David McGoldrick's in the team, and he does bring an awful lot more to the table rather than goals. You know, he links the play up so well, he creates the space for others, and it's interesting, even when you speak to the players here off the record about David, you know, he's one that they all mention as being an absolutely sort of nightmare to play against in training, you know, and just sort of underline how much they actually enjoy having him out there on the pitch with them. This is a player who'd just been released by Ipswich Town when he came to Sheffield United. You know, didn't actually have a football club. And again, you do wonder how somebody of his sort of talent, obviously perhaps not in the 6-yard box, but his talent further back up the pitch was available on a free transfer. But again, just comes down to opportunity.
Mm, brilliant stuff from Sheffield United. How long have you been covering the Blades, James?
I think it's certainly over 15 years. I think it's about 17 or 18 years now.
So for you, how extraordinary is it to be witnessing a season, a campaign like this one?
It is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, obviously they've been in the Premier League before in my time here, but I think what's different about this is the speed that they've made the sort of the climb through the divisions, the speed that they've done that in. I mean, obviously they were a League One club when Chris Wilder was appointed in 2016, and a League One club in a coma. The year they were promoted, that was actually their sixth season in the third tier. I think the one thing what makes this story perhaps not extraordinary, but so sort of lovely to sort of cover and to have witnessed unfolding is sort of the characters that are involved at the club. Because, you know, I mean, I know a lot's been mentioned of it, and it's not down to this, because ultimately it's because they're, you know, they're good players and they're good coaches and good managers. But obviously you've got a manager at the football club who is not only a former player, but a sort of a lifelong supporter of Sheffield United. You've got a captain at the football club who's, you know, who is a lifelong sort of Sheffield United supporter as well. And up until very recently, you had a co-owner who's a lifelong supporter. So there's something just sort of quite nice and homely about that, if you know what I mean. And I think that was one of the really nice things about the story of, you know, of their progression in recent years.
James Shield of the Sheffield Star. Nice alliteration there, actually.
Yeah. Just on the thing about Sheffield United doing a league double over Arsenal.
Oh, yeah.
If it happens, first time since 46-47. The strange thing about that season, none of us will remember, but the winter of 47 was the hardest winter ever. So there were loads of postponed games. Sheffield United's last game that season was the Arsenal match at Bramall Lane. It's one of only two games ever in English top flight history to be played in June, because it dragged on that long. Obviously, it wouldn't happen now with modern football's excellent drainage facilities.
Yeah.
I don't know, climate change, we might get there.
Right, indeed. Well, a little bit of history there, Duncan, and that's not the only bit of history that relates to this game, because bigger than all of Arsenal's issues and Sheffield United's issues, this is a milestone match for one very special man.
Here's a happy tune.
A happy tune.
You'll love to croon.
You love to croon.
They call it Dean's song.
Hey, you don't seem to understand.
Catchy as can be.
I must agree.
The melody.
The melody.
They call it Dean's song.
Dean's song, because his name's Mike Dean.
But not Mike Dean, the producer Mike Dean of some of Kanye's early albums.
So you say, Duncan. Well, anyway, what's special about this weekend for this Mike Dean?
500 games, which for a player would be a landmark achievement, for a referee is monumental.
Right.
But he's one of the most iconic figures in the Premier League's history.
And for one fifth of those, he's given red cards.
Oh, that's great knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah. 102 red cards, 152 penalties he's awarded. Only Liverpool have ever got more penalties.
152 penalties in 500 games, yeah. Or 499.
The weird thing as well, 500 games, right? Yes. That is 4.7% of all games in Premier League history, which I kept thinking about yesterday. Like, almost 5% of games in the history of the Premier League have had Mike Dean in the middle, which...
Yeah, it feels like it as well.
Given that you can only do 1 in 10 on every single weekend.
I know.
Is Mike Dean a fellow who brings some much-needed fun to the joyless world of refereeing, or a rampant egomaniac with cards? Daniel, what's your view?
Somewhere in the middle, I think. I think he's a decent referee. I don't think it helps... I think it helps him to be like that. I don't think it helps his colleagues for him to be like that, because he does bring an air of accidental slapstick to it, which I think then makes people think referees are incompetent because Mike Dean's an egomaniac. So the cliche about referees is don't be the centre of attention, don't be the story.
Right.
And it does feel like probably now, kind of organically, just as he walks on the pitch, he becomes the story, which I don't think is that helpful.
Well, are you happy or unhappy when you see that Mike Dean is officiating a game you're watching?
I'm happy in the sense that I go back to when I was younger and really enjoyed Mr. Bean. And it's quite fitting that his name, Mr. Dean, rhymes with Mr. Bean.
Interesting.
I think it's the facial expressions. I mean, people talk about Phil Jones and his gurning and all those screen grabs, but you could make a montage, a beautiful one, out of Mike Dean's facial expressions.
I think Mike Dean's more Jasper Carrot for me, although I do see where you're coming from. So many great memories. I'm not sure what your favourite is, listener. You've got... The popular time when he made Frank Lampard retake a penalty 3 times against West Ham. The time he hid, more recently, Sergio Aguero's hat-trick ball.
Well, Mike Dean's hiding the ball there. A referee with a sense of fun. There you go. Well played, Mr. Dean.
Martin Tyler certainly enjoyed that.
He's like an uncle where on Christmas morning, you don't see him that often, so on Christmas morning you're like, oh, he's great fun, I love Mike, he's great. And by Christmas afternoon you're like... Do you want to go to the pub, mate? Just you go out and I'll play with my presents.
He refereed famously as well, another Martin Tyler moment, the Aguero goal against QPR. And he peels away with the Manchester City fans. And the moments that we've seen him secretly celebrating. And there was a big question mark over whether he was a huge, staunch Spurs fan because of the amount of decisions that have gone against Arsenal but have also gone for Spurs when he's been refereeing. And there was that one where he had his hands in the air against Aston Villa.
Right,
and there's a video on YouTube of that. And apparently, I think his retort to that was that he was celebrating that he'd let the advantage flow and that it resulted in such a lovely
goal.
It's a
classic move, the Mike Dean advantage given. There's that famous, equally on YouTube, shot of him racing upfield, arms pumping, a bit like a condor.
Yeah, that was at Whiffen.
Clearing a particularly tricky Andy and
he almost
peak.
Took off. Yeah. And the goal scored by Jermaine McSporran past Bruce Grubbelaar, which is a rare occurrence.
Were you there?
I was there.
No way.
Yeah, but it was in...
Because that was in 98.
98, and at the time, Mike Dean hadn't refereed in the Premier League. He was just a young ref making his name, and I would have thought, oh, who's this young ref who's inevitably going to give some bad decisions? I didn't realise just what I was witnessing.
You witnessed the dawn of greatness.
But he kind of looked... The weird thing is, he looks the same then as he...
Yeah,
know.
He hasn't
he's aged quite well because Mike Dean is younger than Damon Albarn, which...
What?
He's younger than Damon Albarn, which if you go back 10 or 15 years, that seemed extraordinary. But now you're kind of like, well, yeah, I can kind of see it. So hats off to Mike Dean's ageing process, if nothing else.
No, I think it's that he's a little Benjamin Button. So he's got an older face before his time and then grows into the
It's enough
the
about
face.
Little Button. So, the camera's caught him going full, let's go to the disco, celebrating a Tranmere win.
Tranmere goal, yeah. And he's standing almost like, remember when Arsene Wenger got sent off against Manchester United back in the day and he stood on like a little shelf in the crowd. It looked like that. Even at that point, he is like, well, I'm going to get on telly here because I'm Mike Dean.
The weirdest clip of all is the one where he turns up as a caddy.
Yes.
A golf caddy on the European ladies tour.
Yeah, he does that regularly, yeah. He does
so
that regularly.
What's the background on that?
He's just, I think he's friends with the golfer and, yeah, he caddies for that golfer on the ladies European tour when he can.
Right. He looks like he enjoys life, which is the thing. And
I think that's the thing I like about
him. And people talk about biases as well. And obviously, as a Tranmere fan, he's very rarely been given the chance to referee Liverpool and Everton. And that Liverpool-Everton derby in the Premier League last year was the first time he'd ever refereed a Premier League game at Anfield. Uh-huh. And Liverpool, three games, he's only refereed them in the Premier League. They've won all three. Everton, five games, and they've never won. So,
wow. Okay. Well, Arsenal, with Mike Dean, what's their record with him?
Well, they used to have a really bad record, and it was a kind of very early kind of social media kind of meme where Arsenal fans were, oh no, Mike Dean, we never win. But that's kind of switched around, and he's refereed so many games for so many different teams that there's no real pattern, really.
Okay. Well, Whitney Hillier, by the way, is the women's golfer that he caddies for. Of course, he'll be dealing with two other clubs this time around. Arsenal, Sheffield United, etc. and so on. All right, well, that's going to be really interesting. By the way, if you're crazy for more Mike Dean reading, if, for example, you are Mike Dean yourself, then get along to totallyfootballshow.com, where Nick Miller is about to drop a big, big in-depth profile on Mike Dean, the causes of Mike Dean, all that stuff.
Is that going to include some of his worst decisions? I know we should also celebrate, because after 500 games, he's clearly got a lot right. But does anyone have any standouts of when he's got decisions really wrong?
I think that's his problem of his own creating, in that he seems a comedy figure. Like, you do not referee 500 games in the Premier League unless you are a very, very good referee. But he's never, I don't think he's ever got the World Cup gigs or that sort of thing, has he? He's always been a kind of...
Which is a shame.
And in other news referee.
Mm. He's always been the kind of... the domestic icon, whereas your Howard Webbs and your Atkinsons,
all their Clattenbergs
will get the kind of international fame and recognition. Mm. So he's very much a kind of... a band that was big in the UK but never made it elsewhere.
I think we can live safe in the knowledge that that does bother him as well.
Yeah.
He's never
I'd love to see him go internationally, even as a guest referee in, say, Chile or Colombia.
Well, do you remember when people used to say, oh, we need to get Pierluigi Collina across to referee Premier League games? But that was purely because of his media profile, and fans in Italy didn't rate him at all, as far as I understand.
Well, there was, that's
it's because we were all brought up on the Demon Headmaster, so we wanted those starry eyes.
We'll get into that Collina thing, not today, but in a future. Golazzo, I think. By the way, if you are a fan of our retro stylings on the Golden Age of Calcio, then there's a new one of those out this week, all about Gigi Riva. Let's get back to the Premier League weekend anyway, after this.
Join me on my journey through time. Where shall we go, sir? Ancient Egypt. Caesar's Rome. No, my kitchen about an hour ago. Told the wife her new hairstyle was a brave choice, didn't I? Ugh. It's easy to mess things up these days. That's why Paddy Power do money-back specials, so not all mistakes cost you as much. This Sunday, it's money-back as a free bet on all markets if Salah scores against Man United. Paddy Power, home of the money-back special.
On this match only, max free bet £10, pre-match singles only, online exclusive, no shop bets, T's and C's apply, 18+, begambleaware.org.
on Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere. This is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Early game Saturday, Watford Spurs. Watford's clash with Tranmere, we mentioned, postponed. Spurs did play against Middlesbrough in their FA Cup replay. A 2-1 win, any better from Spurs?
They started well purely because Middlesbrough helped them, and then they looked a little bit ragged again second half. They haven't impressed over those two games at all. I think this is game of the weekend to watch, even Liverpool-Man United, because I think that'll be quite regulation. I think this is the game of the weekend with Tottenham coming off about the poor run, Watford, the form non-Liverpool team in the country.
Well, form non-Liverpool and Man City, because only those two teams, the top two in the Premier League, have won more points since Nigel Pearson took over at Vicarage Road.
Yeah, and that's the kind of, although in very different circumstances, the response to the Mourinho stuff, because the whole thing about Mourinho is, well, it's going to take time. We can't expect the normal lift off of form. Nigel Pearson has done that from a horrible situation. You know, he's changed the formation. He's moved players everywhere. Like the change in Decore was, who was playing in a midfield two. He's now the advanced of three midfielders. He was scored last week. Mm. He's put De La Feo out wide. He's playing Sarr every week. He's got Deeney in a one rather than a two, which Flores was trying to do. So yeah, they look like a team completely reinvented.
Well, their conversion rate's gone up from 4.8%, yeah, which was terrible, and with relegation essentially, to 15.5%.
Well, he talked about just giving the players some belief and some confidence, and you know, it's completely immeasurable, but that sort of measure. But you see it in things like the finishing. If the strikers are confident, if the wingers are confident, if they're creating better chances. Yeah, they just look reinvented.
This also coincides with Troy Deeney coming back to full fitness, because that had only happened. He'd only just come back into the team before Nigel Pearson arrived. And I don't want to take anything away from what Nigel Pearson's bought. I think Deeney himself has been very complimentary about his time. But I do think that without Deeney, Watford are a different side. And he's got to take some of the credit as well.
The one player I do like shout out for is Nathaniel Chalabar, who's now, because of this switch in formation, has come into midfield alongside Kapuwe. And yeah, he's had such rotten luck with injuries. He obviously was part of that Chelsea loan farm. He ended up at Napoli for a while, and he was at, you know, finally got the permanent move to Watford and then got another serious injury. So kind of good on him, because he's one of those who Gareth Southgate, like Fabian Delph, he absolutely loves and would give any chance to get back into that England squad, I think.
Mm. One interesting thing about this game, the fact is it is two clubs who have decided to make the switch to a new manager mid-season. And while Watford have seen an incredible bounce under their new man, what can we say about Spurs under Mourinho?
Well, I mean, of those two managers, one of them has laid the foundations of a Premier League title win more recently than the other.
Right.
And that man isn't Jose Mourinho, probably.
I see. Jose Mourinho at Spurs is so fascinating, writes Daniel Story, because for the first time he didn't get to cherry pick his ideal club in his perfect situation. He is having to compromise.
Yeah, well, I mean, purely the fact that he'd never been appointed, since his first job, he'd never been appointed mid-season before. He's always been appointed either last day of May or the first 2 days of June and had a full summer to go at it. So the problems we're seeing, you know, loads of different midfield combinations, different switches in formation, a kind of attack that's been left to kind of work it out by itself. They're the things he normally tries to sort out in pre-season, and is having to do that on the job. When he was appointed, they were 11 points off the top four, and everyone was like, this has got awful. 10 games later, they're now 9 points off the top four. So it's not, you know, it's not as if he's boosted or jolted them in the right direction quickly.
I mean, there was a bit of backlash with some of the reaction to last weekend, because, you know, saying that they were playing Liverpool and they did okay in the second half and, you know, actually gave Liverpool a few problems. But I think, don't judge them on that game, judge them on the other ones. And like, there wasn't a massive improvement against Middlesbrough, and some of the other Premier League games haven't been that impressive. I mean, I know a few Spurs fans are saying, look, just this season's essentially a bit of a write-off, and if they can do well in the Champions League and or FA Cup, then that's okay. But the league does look, they're just too inconsistent to kind of make up that gap to the top four.
Well, at the moment, they're winning the transfer window, aren't they? Jedson Fernandez.
The only player.
The only significant player.
Yeah, right. He's a funny one in that, without being too conspiracy theory, he is a Jorge Mendes client. Mourinho is a Jorge Mendes client. There is an insinuation that he's a kind of favour to Mendes so that they get first dibs on other players, because he only started three games, league games, for Benfica in 2019 behind Adil Tarapt in the pecking order. He's not 18, he's 21 years old. There's an option to buy him for $55 million after 18 months, which sounds, you know, pie in the sky stuff, really. And I don't think we'll see that much of him this season. I really don't.
Also facing a tricky away fixture, by the way, Chelsea, who are at Newcastle. Newcastle buoyed by that massive win midweek against Rochdale.
I want to make a case for why this is a really important match for Chelsea, because it's the final one before they face pretty much every rival they've got for the top four for a Champions League place finish. Ooh. Afterwards, they go on to face Arsenal, they go away to Leicester, they've got Manchester United and Spurs. So this is a really important match, I think, for Frank Lampard to get right. And I think they have to come away with 3 points.
What are their chances of doing that, do you think?
They've had a bit of a bogey team, Newcastle. They've won the last few, I think, or four of the last five.
Chelsea won seven of their last nine against Newcastle.
Well, they have also lost 5 of 15, so it depends how you flip the numbers, really.
I guess.
But no, they are playing a Newcastle team who have nothing to lose because they have a horrific
Except
injury.
More players.
Oh, yeah, exactly. A horrific injury record. I thought it was funny, Steve Bruce saying, it's mad. I can't believe it. We need to investigate where these injuries come from. And someone tweeted that he pretty much said exactly the same quote, Aston Villa and Sheffield Wednesday and Wigan and Hull and Sunderland.
So what are you suggesting, Dan?
Well, there is an accusation from Newcastle fans, who some of them are slightly biased against Steve Bruce, that he basically picks players like Sam Maximan when they are half fit and makes injuries worse, which is exactly what happened to Marcus Rashford this midweek as well.
Right.
The Christmas schedule didn't allow him to change, so he just picked half fit players, basically.
Okay.
This game's a rare clash of two published fiction authors, which is quite good.
Yeah.
Wait a second. What was Frank Lampard's book?
Oh, he had children's
magic,
books.
Magic, yeah. Magic Fruits?
No, yeah.
How many other managers are there out there who are published authors? Fiction authors?
Not many in the fiction world. So this is...
There's some debate about Steve Bruce, it should be said, in that the rumour is that he was...
Yeah.
He lent his name to it and someone else wrote them, but...
Yeah, Frankie's Magic Football was the Frank Lampard.
There you go,
book.
I've got a few of them.
Magic Football, or the copies of the book?
Copies of the book.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you say, Steve Bruce in broad in a kind of... Francis Bacon,
very,
yes. Shakespeare style.
Very nice.
I think there's enough stuff
you
in there.
You think Shakespeare definitely wrote them?
No, I don't think that at all. But I think there's enough references in the Bruce oeuvre to suggest that he was the author. Definitely.
Right. I'd like to think so. So don't go disabusing me of that. But Chelsea, yeah. I mean, inconsistent in their form. Newcastle on a bit of a bounce. Tough place to go. At least that's... Your kind of muscle memory suggests that.
Yeah, and they've been better against better opposition this season. They beat Manchester United at home. They beat Tottenham away. They will consider it as a let's have a go game.
By the way, if you're a Chelsea fan and would like to reminisce about George Weah's time at Stamford Bridge, then Nick Miller's got your back. He's done a piece on that as well. That's at thetotallyfootballshow.com, because it's 20 years ago that the Ballon d'Or winner joined the Blues.
Also gathering pace, if we're talking transfer window still being open, is Chelsea going in for Ben Chilwell, because something has developed as well whereby Brendan Rodgers has made an inquiry about Luke Shaw at Manchester United. So you think, well, if that turn of events happens, it might be more of a summer transfer, because they might say we want to keep hold of him for this season now that Leicester are third.
Who would you rather have, Ben Chilwell or Luke Shaw?
Chilwell.
Although his form, I've seen Leicester's last two games, and by all accounts, the game before that as well, his form's dropped off a cliff. Rodgers has been switching between a back four and a back three with him at wing back, which maybe isn't helping him as much. But yeah, he just looks... He's got that Ashley Young disease where he gets the ball and then rather than attacking his man, just turns back and passes it back, which is not what you want from a wing back.
Maybe his head has been turned by the speculation.
Yeah, a disease that Inter Milan are very keen on. By the way, Olivier Giroud set to go this weekend.
Right.
So that looks
Ashley Young is very much on the back burner now.
Yes, but what is it with Inter Milan and wanting older Premier League stars?
I mean, to be fair, people in Italy are probably saying the same thing about Premier League clubs in the late 90s. George Weah.
Andreas Iliadis.
All right, don't.
That's anyway Newcastle's clash with Chelsea. Up next, those relegation battles.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
As you say, Lindsay, huge games, huge. Bottom two, Norwich and Bournemouth facing each other, while the team just above them, Aston Villa, visit Brighton, knowing a win could see them swap places with the Seagulls. Wow. Norwich-Bournemouth is Saturday at 3 o'clock. 9 Premier League games without a win for Norwich. 9 defeats and 11 for Bournemouth. This should be a sizzler.
It's massive for Eddie Howe, I would say, because it really is looking a bit bleak for Bournemouth. And if they lose this game, they can decide. I mean, they could get rid of him, which would be massive, yeah, given it's Eddie Howe and Bournemouth. He went to Burnley and he came back, as we've discussed on that song. But they need to. I mean, Callum Wilson, right, has gone 1,021 minutes of play without a shot on target. You could watch the last two series of Game of Thrones in that time and still have 71 minutes to prepare food and go to the toilet. Probably not at the same time.
I wouldn't suggest it.
But, I mean, that is a long time, isn't it?
It is a long time. If you're fans of last time statistics, then the last time Bournemouth won at Carrow Road, they were actually Bournemouth and Boscombe Athletic. That was back in October 1959.
I've spent some time at the club at Bournemouth this week. I sat down and spoke to Jefferson Lerma via a translator, so I can't say that it's wholly accurate what I'm about to say. But in terms of Eddie Howe being under pressure, I did ask him about that, and he said it doesn't need to signal the end, which I thought was an interesting response to that.
Mm. Although that was via the translator.
It was via the translator.
He might have said something like,
saying,
can't wait for the guy to go.
He said, I just like getting yellow cards. And the translator was like, whoa, I'm not going there.
And of course they're saying all the right things, that there's the belief, there's a lot of hard work going on behind the scenes. He thinks they've got the quality and also the Premier League experience, which could actually come into play to get out of the situation. But there's no denying that if Bournemouth lose this one, then they lose ground on their rivals around them. So West Ham, Villa, if Villa were to win away at Brighton. Whereas if they win and other results go differently, then suddenly they could leapfrog both of them. So it's just right now, it has to be a win.
Yeah, has to be a win. Jefferson Lerma is the player who's picked up, I'm sure you touched on this in your chat with him, the most Premier League bookings since the start of last season. What did he have to say about that?
I didn't ask him about his fouling.
Did you not?
No.
There are times in matches where maybe after 60, 65 minutes, it looks like he realises he hasn't got one yet and thinks, right, OK, let's do something now.
This one's for the fam.
All right. But you mentioned if Villa were to win away at Brighton. They have actually already done that this season in the Carabao Cup. It was a 3-1 win. They also beat Brighton back at Villa Park this season in the league. So,
They just don't have a striker, which is the problem. Wesley's injury is entirely unfortunate, but they clearly don't rate Jonathan Kodjia anymore. In the League Cup game at Leicester, they played Jack Grealish as a false nine. They played Trezeguet as a false nine. They need something up front. There's talk of Christian Benteke coming back, which would make huge sense. But there's just a sense now, whereas at the start of the season, Aston Villa fans
we all took a beat with that sense.
Yeah, sorry.
I was just thinking of Christian Benteke's goalscoring record recently.
But just to be a presence, because at the moment, everything has to go through Jack Grealish. And you can see signs that he is getting frustrated with that, having to carry the team. And, you know, against Manchester City last week, it was embarrassing. He was the only man demanding the ball, beating a player, and then looking frustrated as a teammate lost it.
They might have Pepe Reina, who they have picked up in the January transfer window, making his debut in the...
But it's good. I mean, Pepe Reina is one of my favourite Premier League players, I think. He was a good character. Hmm. And it's good to see him back if he plays. So.
Right. It could be busy there. Although Brighton haven't been troubling the net much themselves of late. Just one win in seven. Neil Mopé, who's their top scorer, hasn't actually registered on the score sheet in six games now in all competitions.
And Dan Byrne has got a serious shoulder injury. He's out for 2 months. Who's played, I think, played every minute of the weirdest left-back in
the world's
Premier
tallest
League.
Left-back, which sounds like Frank Lampard's next book, to be fair.
He is a sight to behold, isn't he, up close?
So, yeah, they'll be playing...
How tall is he?
6 foot six, I think.
Okay.
It's in that position, though. Yeah. You see him in that position up close.
Why is that, Lindsay? Why is it the full-backs are usually shorter?
I always thought that was a sort of position where a lower centre of gravity is advantageous, getting forward, getting back. There's a lot of changes of direction. Yeah.
Because a big man up top, or your big centre halves, that's where you generally expect height.
Long balls are generally, I suppose, aimed at a striker's head, and therefore centre backs would be taller and need to be stronger. And yeah, full backs would have been, you know, maybe 60, 70 years ago, there would have been no difference. But now they are seen as the players needing the most energy on the pitch, which isn't necessarily linked to a... You know, but I think
you have less
frame.
Energy when you're tall, then. Just short people have more energy.
I've got bags of it.
And I used to play right back or
did
right
you?
Midfield.
Don't.
Yeah, but then I was shorter when I did that. So it kind of countered my
but
own
relative
point
to the other.
And you're
players,
not 6 foot six.
I was 6 foot three.
Are you?
Yeah.
So
you don't feel like 6 foot three.
Yeah, a lot of people don't Yeah.
Little people.
You carry it lightly. Yeah.
Lots of people.
Everyone used to marvel, didn't they, at Peter Crouch's touch for a big man.
Well.
And yeah. I actually say that was the first thing I was watching close was Dan Burn's feet and his touch with the ball. He's got really good feet.
These two teams playing nice football.
Yeah, this is the thing with Brighton, is that I've really enjoyed watching Brighton this year. I think they're playing in a very progressive way. Matt Ryan has been probably one of the most underrated players in the Premier League this season.
And by the way, did you see how much money he's raised for the animals in
Australia?
It's
good to see a statistic charity mega combo. I liked it. So, but even so, they still look like they're in a bit of trouble. So I hope for justice sake that they can get out of it.
Well, defeat might put them into the bottom three. Depends what other games do. Games like Burnley's clash with Leicester. Burnley, like Brighton, are potentially one defeat from the bottom three. They've lost their last four in a row. They've only scored four goals in their last nine Premier League matches, and Leicester, you'd imagine, will be a bit fired up for this one.
They need to be, because they've been pretty wretched. Not wretched, but they've been very sluggish in the last few matches.
Leicester?
It feels like Brendan Rodgers and his players have almost got a sense of where they are, having coasted and lived the dream for a while. They've just slowed down. Some of the passing is a bit sluggish. Some of the movement is not quite what they want. James Maddison's chance creation has kind of dropped right off. Vardy's not been as prolific. And, you know, they are still 11 points ahead. Their start to the season gave him a huge cushion, but he will be keen to address that little run.
Yeah, we saw Storm Brendan blow itself out this week, and it feels like very much, etc. But, yeah, I think also Vardy missing that game for the birth of his child, which is a fairly valid reason, but he's not really hit the ground running since then.
No.
Rodgers obviously has been switching, as you said earlier, Daniel, between a back three and back four, which I think looks more than anything like it's just confused Leicester. And obviously they're missing Ndidi massively, I think.
Yeah.
Interesting conversation as well about English managers, because we talked about Eddie Howe being under scrutiny. This is also Sean Dyche going through a really bad spell with Burnley. Mm. And he seems to have gone a little unnoticed. And I wonder if we're just a bit susceptible as media to talking about the teams that are in the relegation zone or just about on the cusps of it. Because I think Graham Potter at Brighton and Sean Dyche have got off quite lightly this season, really, in terms of everyone was waxing lyrical about Potter and the style, which I do admire, but you have to look at the results on the board. They could be dragged into it, as could Burnley. And I think I said a couple of weeks ago, either here or on the Offside Roll, that Burnley worry me for relegation. Mm. It's just been a slow free fall.
Obviously, the thing with Burnley, a couple of seasons ago, they finished in the top eight. None of the numbers back that up, really. No one could really work out how they allowed the opposition so many shots, but still, were pretty good. And it looks like all those issues are coming home to roost now, and they are in a bit of trouble.
All right, let's add West Ham into that mix. They're only a point above the bottom three, and they're taking on an Everton team who've won three of their four games in the Premier League under Carlo Ancelotti.
And won them 1-0, the two home games, which is big for Everton, because I think there was an idea that Everton fans demand this sexy footballer, this, in inverted commas, Everton way. I don't think that's true at all. What they wanted to avoid was another firefighter, another sixth-month contract. And their aim with Ancelotti, I think, was to get the best of both worlds, was to get a long-term manager, but also one that would tighten them up very quickly. And, as I say, they've won both their home games 1-0. They lost 2-1 at Manchester City, which is no great disgrace, but this is a massive game in terms of PR for both clubs. Mm, this is absolutely huge, I think.
And also for points in the table for West Ham. David Moyes' record against Everton, not great. He's lost 5 of his 6 Premier League meetings against
But he has got an excellent record against Ancelotti. He's never lost against him in the Premier League.
That's true.
This fixture was amazing a few seasons ago when Allardyce was managing Everton and Moyes was managing West Ham, and it really was like face-off. You were like, what is going on here?
In terms of quality in the team, which manager can get the best out of? And for David Moyes, it has to be Felipe Anderson, who's a quality player but just gone missing this season. Lanzini, what can he get out of him? Mm. And then on the flip side of that for Everton, you've started to see Ancelotti getting more out of Richarlison and Sigurdsson. And
Bernard.
Yeah.
Mm. Bernard.
Calvert-Lewin's the one, I think. West Ham have really struggled defending set pieces this season. Mm. Really struggled. Well, just defensive organisation, really. They've dropped Issa Diop, but for the last few weeks they've been playing Balbuena and Ogbonna. Diop's great in the air, so I think Calvert-Lewin's the interesting matchup, maybe.
In the meantime, a lot of concern this week about Everton's finances. What was the issue there?
Well, they've announced that they will raise 30 million by giving
Usmanov.
Yeah, effectively giving Usmanov first dibs on naming rights.
So he's paid 30 million not for the naming rights, but for having first dibs on them.
Yeah, which...
Right. We've all done it, to be fair.
Several other clubs have pointed out is, they might not be completely by the book and they would like to see just an investigation into
In terms of financial fair play?
Yeah, exactly right. Because whether that's acceptable.
Simultaneously, they announced record losses of almost 112 million.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, if I read that, I think, oh, your clubs do that. But are they heading towards a bit of a problem or is this all rectifiable?
I think they're in trouble. They would be in huge trouble if they went down. The broadcasting revenues in the Premier League are such that by staying up, I suspect they've committed a lot of money to the new stadium already, though, that project.
But this is before that's even
Yeah, it's before
underway.
It's been built, yeah. Mm. But they have spent, you know, they gave Marco Silva 100 million in both of his summers.
Right.
So it's not a huge surprise. If you finish 12th, 13th in the Premier League, having spent 100 million a summer, it's not great, is it?
Mm. All right. Well, after this, we'll be touching on the remaining games, the ones we haven't covered yet. Man City, Crystal Palace, Saints, Wolves, and yes, the biggie at Anfield. So, Man City taking on Crystal Palace. Ooh, last season, Palace winning this fixture 3-2, and Andros Townsend did this.
Winning the second ball, and Townsend! That is an unbelievable strike! Crystal Palace lead at Manchester City, but not just that, they do it with one of the goals of the season.
For anyone not in front of that YouTube clip, Daniel, what was that noise?
It was an Andros Townsend scissor volley that I'll describe as Mark Hughes on heat.
Nice.
Mark Hughes back in the... Not Mark Hughes as a player, I should say, rather than manager. Very different beasts. Mm.
Again, just taking a beat with that. City, though, have a terrific record, generally speaking, against Palace, and they're also doing... They're on a bit of a run at the moment. 4 out of 4 in all comps since the turn of the year. They've scored 15 goals in those 4 games. Riyad Mahrez is looking particularly deadly.
Yeah, you feel now that the title's essentially gone and they're kind of free to just experiment in the league, you kind of think they're going to go a bit crazy for the rest of the season. You could almost see them, you know, they won 6-1 last weekend. I can see them winning 6-1 again a fair few times before May. So.
Wow. Could this weekend, do you think?
I don't think 6. I think they'll win maybe 3-1.
Okay.
As I say, on Mahrez, I think I'm right in saying goals and assists per minute played this season in the Premier League. I think he's second only to Sergio Aguero. So he's kind of gone under the radar as he got a bit of criticism last season having joined, but he's actually been absolutely brilliant this season, I think.
Mm. Okay. Palace's last 3 Premier League fixtures have all ended 1-1, but now they have Cenk Tosun. Cenk Tosun.
Cenk the hairline Tosun.
Do you think he'll play at the Etihad? Will they start him?
I suspect he'll start on the bench as he did last weekend.
Okay.
For strikers like that, I think it's probably nice to give them their first start in a gentle-ish home game.
Mm. I mean, it ties back into what we were saying about Everton a minute ago. You know, he's on big wages and just getting rid of him on loan for a few months is kind of helpful to Everton.
Okay. Saints, meanwhile, who have won 5 of their last 6 in all competitions, are taking on Wolves. Lindsay, how concerned are you about this?
Very. I'm very concerned. I think Wolves are tired. Was it 38th match of the season, midweek? And the thing is that there's very little rotation. And not only that, we've lost players. So Vallejo's gone back to Real Madrid.
Right.
Catrone's gone to Fiorentina. And we haven't brought anyone in this window yet. And if you look at the squad size, and Jota being injured, if anything happens to Jimenez... We really are going to call on Steve Ball to come in.
But you are the club who basically run by an agent. So why have you got such a short squad?
I don't really understand why the squad list is so short. I think it's more from Nuno's preference. He likes to have a regular starting 11 and then just dip in and out. It isn't really his style to have a really long squad ever. So I didn't expect it to be the case that we would have... lots of depth. But I think when you're playing in Europe as well, we're still in the Europa League, it's really starting to tell. I mean, Connor Cody must be a machine. He's not had a minute off.
Cody.
If I was Nuno,
ZX Spectrum.
If I was Nuno, I'd be furious. I really would. Like, he looked at the bench last weekend, they're playing Newcastle at home and they need a goal. And he's got a goalkeeper, 4 defenders, a central midfielder, Morgan Gibbs-White, who is extremely inexperienced and isn't really you know, he's not a goal threat necessarily. And then Benny Ashley-Seal, who has never played a senior game for Wolves. Yeah. And that's it. That's his only option.
And I was at the Newcastle match. I also watched the FA Cup game against United. I watched the first round of that as well. And all of those performances, there wasn't the zip, there wasn't the pace, there wasn't the flow of the ball. I think players like Moutinho as well, who's a little bit older, who's a fantastic player for us, but he's looking tired, I think. His deliveries for free kicks, corners, haven't been quite as good. I mean, they've been brilliant overall, but just in recent games. And I think it's just that last bit of edge to the team that's now lacking. And I think it's really concerning going up against a team like Southampton who are in form.
This wasn't a surprise, though. Like, this was always Wolves' aim, was to get through the Europa League group stage. And doing that meant you were probably going to play 60 matches in the season. So to have basically 13 fit first team players, which they do at the moment, is and to have sold Cavallero and Catrone and let Vallejo go, as you say, it's a really, really odd one.
Yeah, in the replay in midweek, it looked like they spent the first half trying to conserve energy, like we've got 20 minutes of full gas to go with. And then right at the end of the game, was it Vinagre that did his hamstring, just chasing back on a one-on-one that United had and then wasted.
So can't afford any injuries. The only shining light is that Morgan Gibbs-White came back in for that match, back from injury. He'd had quite a serious back problem and looked really bright. So Nuno's going to be looking to the Fosens, I think, over the next week, 2 weeks, to say, how are you going to help here? And then you've got Danny Ings to contend with as well.
Ings can only get worse, though.
Oh, for goodness sake, Duncan. Well, that's enough of that. I'm going to move on to Sunday at Anfield, where Liverpool take on Man United. Man United, the last team to take points off Jurgen Klopp's teams. Wow. I take your point about Watford Spurs, but this is huge, Daniel.
Yeah, no, it's huge for both clubs. I don't think it's necessarily as huge for the Premier League, because I think everything's pretty much done and dusted with Liverpool. But yeah, it's huge for both clubs, of course. What I think was really interesting is that Solskjaer brought on Marcus Rashford on Wednesday night when he said he wasn't fully fit, but he also said, I need to win the FA Cup game. Rashford then picks up a knock and is probably going to be out of this weekend, or suffered a setback, certainly. But it just shows quite how much Solskjaer
really... Well, you say that, but Paul Scholes said if he puts some ice on it, he'll be all right for Sunday.
Dr. Scholes, MD. That to me is a reflection that Solskjaer realises, with the Carabao Cup looking gone, I really need to win something this season to keep my job. I thought it was really interesting. Normally, you would never had someone like Rashford risked in an FA Cup game replay when you had Liverpool away on the weekend. You'd never do that. So I think that's a reflection that he understands his team are quite a long way behind Liverpool.
Right. How big an impact in terms of goal scoring does Rashford's absence represent?
Well, he scored more goals than any Liverpool player this season. But as we know, the game is not about individuals. It's
right,
about
but they are
team.
Playing Liverpool this weekend.
So. They are, yeah. Well, yeah. But I think this, I mean, Daniel kind of mentioned it there. I mean, I think anyone who watches a lot of the Premier League struggles to get super excited about Liverpool v Man United, because inevitably it turns out to be a bit of a damp squib. Now, obviously, the reverse fixture early in the season is the only time Liverpool drop points.
Right.
I saw one Liverpool fan say the nightmare of the season would be to end with a record of 1-37 drawn 1, because United fans would never let them forget it, which is
right.
Yeah, possibly, well, they take it.
You know, they almost didn't even draw that game. So what are the odds of Oli, whose team have performed better in the big games? They beat Man City.
They have, and also this fixture's very... In the 80s, when Liverpool were peerless and United struggled generally, United only lost once at Anfield in that whole decade. And then when United were good in the 90s, Liverpool regularly beat them at Anfield. So generally what happens in this fixture is one of these teams is dominating English football and the other team tends to really raise their game for this match. So I could see United at least getting a draw in this game.
I'm really impressed by Williams.
You're not the only one, actually, Lindsay. Because did you see Gary Neville saying, I like Brandon Williams? Did you see this?
No.
Gary says, I like Brandon Williams. What I like about him specifically is that he has that look in his eye of someone who would eat his opponent's nose to win the match. Keep going, kid! Exclamation mark, says Gary. Oh, he can play football too, which is a bonus. Thumbs up emoji. Eat a nose off.
Well, yeah. Luis Suarez came close, to be fair.
Right. But sorry, Lindsay, what's your...
I just really have admired him for the last few matches, and I think that he's going to have an interesting battle. So he's going to come up against the best in the league now. Right. And it will be a good test for him. I mean, he kept Wolves very quiet. And he kept Adama Traore really quiet. And that's a true test this season. So I think he'll be good. What they need to do is probably do what Wolves do in their matches, which is sit back and wait for those counter-attacking opportunities.
Right, which is what Spurs did against Liverpool, and everyone hammered Mourinho for it. But
it
almost worked.
Yeah, that seems to have been one of the most divisive matches of the season in terms of people watching it. I was there, and I thought it was pretty embarrassing first half for Spurs. It wasn't they were sitting back and trying to play on the counter. It's that they were playing a training ground attack versus defence match against a team who are better at attacking than they are defending and eventually scored.
Which is a big difference.
Yeah, and if Liverpool had added to that lead, you know, they didn't create very many clear-cut chances, but that was because they let little half chances slip, I think. Right. Liverpool could have been 3 or 4 up at half-time. I think Manchester United will have the same problem if they just sit back. That's the big loss with Rashford, is that counter-attacking threat. Mm. You know, they'll play Martial, they'll play Daniel James. It will be interesting to see if they play Greenwood rather than Mata in terms of more pace on the break, because that's the only way you're going to hurt Liverpool.
A couple of other points on this game. Alex Sykes writes in and says, Brandon Williams is the talk of the town. He wears the number 53 shirt because, according to Alex Sykes, that's the bus route he used to take home from Old Trafford. Huge if true.
Giving away where his parents live. Risky business.
Mm. Marcus Rashford, meanwhile, has registered to launch his own range of products.
There have also been links that make me wince of him following Jesse Lingard and joining Mino Raiola as a client.
Oh, really?
Which comes 2 weeks after Raiola said Manchester United could make any player bad. So it seems an odd... Yeah. Very odd move.
Rashford, just on this topic, has filed papers with the government's intellectual property office, i.e. he's taken out a copyright. Among the products he's registered to release are clothes, jewellery, books, umbrellas, duvet covers, kitchen utensils and toilet roll. Just, you know, I mean, that's the modern footballer, I guess. Hey-ho. Duncan can see Man United getting a point in this game. What do you think, Lindsay?
I think it's all going to come down to that first goal. I think if United can get in front, then they can potentially grind out a draw. I think Liverpool will get a goal in this match. And if Liverpool score first, especially if they score early in the first half, I can see them winning this 3-1.
Running away with it. All right. Yeah. Daniel?
I think home win. I think Liverpool will win 2-0. And as I say, with the selection in the FA Cup, I think Manchester United fans, maybe even Manchester United manager, are kind of half resigned to that anyway.
Well, loads more to come in the show. We're going to be touching on some of the big stories from around the continent, following up on one or two things that we mentioned in Tuesday's European edition. Also, many more of your tweets, including Back to Basics, my correction on Zlatan. First, though, Paddy Power.
Well, fancy seeing you here, listeners. Yes, this is producer Ben. I'm on the line with Lee Price from Paddy Power. Lee, let's talk about the big games this weekend. Man U are the only team to take Premier League points off Liverpool this season. Can they do it again when the two sides meet at Anfield?
Interesting. At this stage of the season, I couldn't say with any confidence that any side could take points off Liverpool, let alone this Man United team. But what do the numbers say? They echo that. Liverpool are 4-11, odds on to win this one. The draw 7-2, and United are an enormous 13-2 to get all 3 points at Anfield. If you do want to bet United simply not losing this game, you can do that. That's called the double chance, and the odds of that happening are 15-8. And how about this for Money Back Special? Paddy Power are doing Money Back as a free bet on all markets if Mohamed Salah scores against Man United, which he is odds on to do. T&Cs apply.
Elsewhere, Brighton, as we've been saying, haven't beaten Villa since 1980. Is it going to happen on Saturday?
Well, this is a really interesting one, isn't it? It's incredible what narrative can do. In my head, Brighton and Villa are worlds apart, having markedly different seasons. And yet I looked at the table and there's just 3 points separating the two teams. That said, we do make Brighton odds-on favourites to win against Villa for the first time in however many years that is. It's 8-13 they do so. Villa are 7-2 to get the 3 points. The draw here is 16-5.
And finally, we've been going on about Mike Dean's big day. How many cards will he dish out at the Emirates?
A big day for a colossus of Premier League football. We'll miss him when he's gone. I suspect he'll genuinely be looked back on as a refereeing legend, although that could be more for his meme ability than reffing ability. Mike Dean is a showman, of course, and I wonder if he might produce a bit of a flourish for us here. It's 2-1. He dished out 5 or more cards to really mark the special occasion.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply, and when the fun stops, stop. Back to Basics says, Jimbo, can you correct your assertion that Zlatan is the first player to score in four different decades? Yeah, I'm sorry about that, back to basics. I got a little overexcited. I think I phrased it as a question, but clearly he wasn't. As Back to Basics says, there are quite a few, to be honest. The first, I reckon, must be Billy Meredith, who was the oldest player to play for Man City and also holds the same record for Man United. Others include, again, this is Back to Basics, Stanley Matthews, Jari Litmanen, and of course, Kazumura, who's just signed a new deal with Yokohama. So he's probably onto like five decades by now.
Feels like cheating now, doesn't it? 53 years old.
A lot of the stories we're talking about on Tuesday's excellent European roundup with Rafa, Jules Alvaro, and James Horncastle. We were waxing lyrical about Monaco's terrific performance against Paris Saint-Germain at the weekend when they drew 3-3 away in Paris. Two teams met again on Wednesday. This time Monaco didn't go so well for the Monegas. Daniel?
No, 4-1.
4-1 to PSG. In Spain, Ernesto Valverde had just walked when we did Tuesday's show. The job has gone to Quique Setién. Matas Williams saying, what would be the English equivalent of Setién taking over at Barcelona? Chris Wilder at Man City?
Yeah, asked Matas. I saw that tweet. I was trying to think. I don't think there's an obvious example in that the club, our clubs of that ilk of Betis, maybe a Southampton, or they're normally managed by.
Maybe so Ralf Hasenhüttl like taking over at Liverpool, would that work?
Yeah. Or when Poch left.
Yeah, maybe Poch to Southampton, but then he went to Spurs, who are not quite as big.
Right.
So I don't think there's a direct example with a domestic.
If Poch had gone straight to United or Chelsea.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Setién, who had tremendous success at Las Palmas, got into 11th, which is their best finish for 40 years. Then at Betis, took them to 6th, gotten them to Europa League, had wins over Barcelona, Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid. More recently, he's been walking around his hometown surrounded by cows, in his own
words. That felt like one of those that was just a throwaway line that then suddenly became everyone's headline,
well,
didn't it?
Yeah.
Don't think I've seen the word cow written out so much.
His brother said, they are my cows.
Was it his brother or his son? Oh, so yeah, his brother. They're his brother's cows, aren't they?
You could say the medium milked, that one.
It's utterly, et cetera, and so on. Right. Good. Anyway, so that's who's now in charge of Barcelona and will be guiding them through their next Copa del Rey fixture, in which they go to Ibiza, Union Deportivo Ibiza. Real Madrid, meanwhile, in the Copa del Rey have drawn, Daniel?
Unionistas.
Right. We talked about them on Tuesday. You wrote a lovely piece about them.
Yeah, a while back for the BBC, actually, about, people might remember, Universidade Salamanca, who were the original club, who folded in 2012, 13, I think. And the president tried to set up his own club and the fans said, no, we're sick of you, we're going to set up our own. And it's interesting in a UK perspective because two of the guys who are very key to setting up the club are both English guys. One lives in Spain and his brother lives in Bath and still goes over 6 or 7 times a year to watch matches. And if you go to the ground, there's a banner for Bath City boat trips, which is what this guy, Tony, runs. It's a really, really nice story of a fan-owned club. They've gained 2 promotions now, so they're in the third tier and knocked out Deportivo in the last round, which was the big story. And then, as you say, drew Real Madrid at home.
Brilliant.
I'm hoping to go to the game. They were so lovely, Tony and this guy Peter. They've offered me free accommodation and all sorts to go over and witness the spectacle.
Brilliant. Salamanca, lovely, lovely place.
Very
to go.
Very nice.
Are they home or away?
Home.
Brilliant. All right. In other cup news, Coppa Italia midweek saw Piontek scoring and assisting as Milan, without Zlatan this time, got another win. This time it was 3-0 over Spal. Juve, meanwhile, rested Cristiano Ronaldo and Higuain and Dybala enjoyed themselves in his absence.
That was incredible. Like they did 3-1-2s.
Like a reboot of the Brolin Darlene thing.
The one, the Cassano Totti would be the example I would go with for Roma. I was a little bit feeling that among the many people admiring their 1-2s were the Udinese defence, who essentially just stood there like training cones as they kind of. Because some of the 1-2ing wasn't exactly accurate.
By the third one, they were definitely just.
Yeah, Higuain just basically booted it, and then Dybala had to stop, go back and pick up the ball, and then do another 1-2, air quotes. All right. Anyway, but Juve through to in the quarterfinals, 4-0 their win there. And
Inter, Mr. Lukaku again.
Yeah, 2 goals this time.
So that's 3rd brace in 4 games now.
I think it's 13-13 for Lukaku.
And 18-25 in all competitions this season, which is.
He's level with Ronaldo, isn't he?
More goals than Messi this season, it should be pointed out.
Brilliant.
But so is Danny Ings, so never mind.
Anyway. Cup news. GSS says, this was a big bit of news, should Liverpool sign any big attacking players in the summer now that AFCON is next January? Yeah. So this is the Cup of Nations, which they'd moved to the summer to avoid clashing with all the big league competitions. What it's now gone back again. Why?
Because they've realised it's quite hot in Cameroon in the summer.
Right.
And Cameroon have said, there's no way we can host this and we'd rather tell you now than tell you much nearer the time. And yeah, it's going to move to January 2021, which, right, as you say, means Aubameyang, Salah, Mane, etc. will miss, I think, 6 Premier League matches.
Wow. Handy for all the people who forgot that it moved to the summer, because the last AFCON, they were like, well, we're going to lose all these players. And I was like, no.
No, don't worry about it, yeah.
Right.
But
right,
going back to Liverpool, yeah, I mean, possibly they'll have spotted that and they will have prepared. I mean,
they'll be on
get
that.
Danny Ings back.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. Well, that wraps it up for today's edition of the Totally Football Show. Remember, our weekend roundup will be available first thing Monday morning, which is very exciting. So as soon as you wake up on Monday, Totally Football Show will be there ready with all our reaction to the weekend's action. Many thanks for being with us today, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Daniel.
Thank you.
And Duncan.
Thank you.
Have yourselves a terrific weekend and we'll catch up with you after.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter, and make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Join Ruby Walsh, Paddy Power, Tom Nugent, and a whole host of great guests each week on Paddy Power's new racing podcast, From the Horse's Mouth. Tune in for analysis, interviews, and a bit of crack from the greatest trio since the Bee Gees. Ha, 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 ha. From the Horse's Mouth. From the Horse's Mouth. Ha, ha, yeah.
Muddy Knees Media.